Now we're going to change course again, and we will be talking, we'll turn our attention to economic issues again with Dr. Chris Martinson. He's an economic researcher and futurist specializing in energy and resource depletion and founder of peakprosperity.com. He will tell us a few probably not so nice facts about the fact that we're facing a worsening supply chain problems, etc. Hello, Chris Martinson.
I think, are you still mute?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Now I can hear you, yeah.
Ah, yes, very good, very good. V. Gates.
Under the circumstances, we're doing okay, or right. Pretty good, actually, because we're beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel, and it's always good to be able to see through what we consider fog that was meant to dilute, or rather to confuse us. But that's the one positive thing about Corona. We're learning all these things. We're learning all the... We are beginning to realize that the system that we're living in is totally corrupt, and we're going to have to restart not this system, but a whole new one.
Exactly. Exactly. I agree very much. And thank you for having me on. It's a real honor. You've been doing extraordinary work all the way through. And I know it's very difficult to get messages out with all the shadow banning and the censorship. And because I run into that myself all the time. And you can feel there's a system that Whitney was just talking about that's nudging us. It wants us to think certain things and not think other things. And I feel like we're being treated like children, you know, not adults who are part of a conversation we ought to be having. In particular, you know, my work looking at resource depletion, I'll tell you, we're facing some really serious, serious predicaments, right? A problem has a solution, but predicaments... they just have outcomes you have to manage, which means we need to make important decisions, right? So that's where I see the world right now. And, you know, Whitney was just talking about what I guess was the figurative dark winter. But Europe's now facing a literal dark winter, right? Because of energy issues and supply chain issues. And it's being blamed on logistics or labor or this or that. But truthfully, it was just a gigantic failure to plan. Back in March of 2020, I was pointing out that there were going to be supply chain issues because of the impact of Corona on manufacturing. We'd had a profound failure to invest in energy production that started in 2016. That's hitting us now. So all these reasons, you know, that they're being given in the media, they're all wrong. They're all childishly wrong. And they're not hard to explain, but for some reason, we never get the right context. The media and the state seem to come together and want us to not really understand what's going on. So that's the approach I take to all of this, is to look at the big picture and try and make sense of it.
So what's going to happen in Europe?
Well, at present, with natural gas stores, it's roughly 70% of where they ought to be at this point. There's a chance that they could dip below certain critical levels that would cause certain countries who have transit gas pipelines to not transit the gas anymore. So we could see a political fracturing because, of course, politically, it's very hard to explain why you would let gas transit through your country while your own citizens are freezing. So... that probably won't happen. We're definitely going to see shortages, blackouts, things like that are for sure coming. There's another prediction that's easy to make, which is looking at the fertilizer manufacturers who are now shutting down because they can't afford to buy the gas to use the Haber-Bosch process to make ammonia-based fertilizers. Without the fertilizer, the next growing season is going to be very skimpy. The fertilizer in many cases needs to go down in fall sometimes or at latest in spring. So if that manufacturing doesn't get resolved in some way, we're going to see massive, massive increases in prices, but if not physical, literal shortages leading to reduced harvests. So, and again, all of this is eminently foreseeable. And for whatever reason, the system decided not to foresee it. I mean, that's why I focused all of 2020 and most of 2021 on just COVID research, because it's a story. When you see how badly the authorities behaved, how corrupt the system is, a corrupt system has no chance of dealing with a predicament appropriately, because a corrupt system, the participants, they act in their own self-interest. So in my country, Anthony Fauci, all he cares about is a few more dollars coming to his buddies and his minions, and he's got a little power of control about how he hands out grant money and how people are rewarded with plum directorships and on boards of pharma companies. It's a whole corrupt little ecosystem, and they couldn't even get out of their own way to do the right thing to provide early treatments in which would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Eh, wasn't worth it. So when you have that level of corruption, say at the CDC, the NIH, the FDA, right, with the FDA just, you know, advisory panel saying, oh, yeah, vaccines for kids seems good with only 1,500 in the trial. There's no way you could get a safety signal out of that. And still 17 of them said, yeah, let's do this. Right. So that level of corruption that exists in every other department. And so the Department of Energy just has the same difficulties. They can't mention the words peak oil. They can't bring themselves to talk about where we really are in this larger resource energy story. And what's interesting is when I talk with people who are very high level in China, they understand all of this. They have no mental blocks against talking about reality as it is. They understand completely where we are in the resource story when it comes to everything from copper to lithium to indium to oil, particularly to natural gas. China's all over the world scouring for those resources, and we can't even figure out how to properly record a COVID death. It's just, it's a ridiculous situation. So the prediction for Europe is it's going to get messy, and I think people ought to be individually resilient and prepared for that, and there's a lot of things people can do. Mm-hmm.
That's the important part, because that gives us a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel, some mm-hmm. things that we can do.
Well, my light at the end of the tunnel is this has started to wake people up again. And I found out who the intellectual frauds and moral cowards are out there in this story. And there's a lot of them. And we've also found out who's burning bright, who stood tall, and who we can really trust, and who has integrity. That's wonderful. I know the doctors all over the world who have integrity. I know the business leaders who have integrity, and they're rallying, right? And that's what we really need to do. So I like that. And I love that I get to interact with people who get it and who care and are genuinely helpful. And we're going to need each other a lot in these coming times because, you know, as I mentioned, we've got some really serious things that we have to resolve, very complex systems. And to listen to how Whitney puts all those pieces together is just brilliant. And what I interact with people who exist at that level from time to time, and they're just people. And they don't understand complexity theory or systems thinking, which means they actually think they can control a complex system. And you can't. The science is very clear. Complex systems have what we call emergent behaviors. You do some things, but then things happen you didn't quite anticipate. So that's what's happening with the energy situation right now. It's a very complex system of breakdowns that are happening. It's a very high chance, not zero anymore, that we could see a cascading series of failures, which are best explained in that little aphorism about for want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the rider was lost. For want of a rider, the message was lost. For want of a message, the battle was lost. For want of the battle, the kingdom was lost. That's sort of a cascading series, but it's linear. We have an economy where because of a chip, a machine couldn't be made. Because the machine couldn't be made, this product couldn't be produced. Because this product couldn't be produced, the chips can't be made. Like we have these circular feedback loops, very complex, very difficult to control. And I think we should have had some better appreciation of the fragility of those systems, as well as too much focus on being cost-effective and efficient and cheapest products, which means businesses ran really lean inventories without a lot of depth or resilience. And because of that, you know, supply chain shocks are amplified. Mm-hmm. You know, the leaner the inventories, the greater the supply chain shocks. You get these standing waves of order and supply demand mismatches. So that's where we are. It's going to take a long time to resolve, and that's only if things go well. If things go badly, one of these circular loops bites us, and we find that we have a very difficult problem, if not predicament, on our hands. So what do you do about that? I think, so all through 2020, I was just doing COVID, right? I was just reporting on COVID, and at the end of every one of my videos, I would end with, hey, plant a garden, right? And so for over time, people thought I was running a really weird guerrilla gardening channel. But my point in that was individual responsibility, individual resilience is how we get through this. And people need to have the ability to be individually resilient. So with this energy crisis in Europe, hey, you know, it's time to buy sweaters. It's time to turn the thermostats down. It's time to insulate your home. It's time to make leaky windows, not leaky. There's a lot of things we can do. But my view is, if we want to be resilient as a country or as a globe, well, you need, that's fractal. It all begins with resilient households. And then we need resilient communities. And so the most important thing I tell people is that it's time for us to begin to get to know each other again, to help each other, to really live in community, which I know I think my country does a less good job at on average than a lot of Europe does. I know that in Germany, you have a much stronger appreciation for nature and the importance of nature and treating it well. And that, I think, is going to be a big determinant as we go forward, because I track many things about resources. And one of the most alarming statistics I have is about the loss of insects. It's just, it's grief inducing. It's so terrible. And so if we don't begin to manage ourselves as a species in alignment with living within our various budgets, we have an ecological budget. We're way over it. We have actual fiscal budgets. We're running deficits that can never be paid back. Never, right? Getting 0.3% on Italian bonds when Italy's, you know, a few hundred billion euros in debt, it can't. Italy would have to pay back, I don't know, 250 billion euros a year for 10 years to even begin to approach paying down its debt. It won't happen. And so that's my larger message here, is that the kind of economic growth that all of our financial money, our markets, our stocks, our bonds, derivatives, currency itself, all are just claims on wealth. And wealth isn't those things. They're claims on it. Real wealth is the wealth that comes out of the land and how people transform that into goods and services. So based on that, it's very easy to sort of look at this. Everybody knows this on some level, that the debts we have right now fiscally, they can't be paid back. The unfunded liabilities, which are beyond debts, a liability being an underfunded pension or endowment or underfunded retirement plan of some kind or social plan. The degree to which those are underfunded in the United States right now is around $200 trillion. How would you ever make up a shortfall of $200 trillion? Well, your economy has to grow a lot. Well, how do economies grow? Well, they use energy to grow. It's really tightly linked. More energy equals more economy. Is there enough energy to grow out of a $200 trillion hole? Nope. Not unless somebody comes up with some weird alien technology or something, but it's not, we don't have it. So then the only question left is, well, if those funds can't be paid back, who's going to eat the losses? That is the scramble that's going on right now. And it begins to explain what the WEF is up to, the whole Davos crowd. It begins to explain, I think, many of the lockdowns. It begins to explain a lot of things that fit through that lens of understanding that we're not going to pay those debts back. There have to be losses. The population generally doesn't like to have losses forced on them. So there has to be another explanation, another reason. That's at least part of this explanation for me right now.
And but in order to you know, that we can maybe take a closer look at all these supply chain problems and all, and really can you know, really get into the position of doing something against it, against them, this whole house of cards has to come down and this pandemic has to end. I mean, that's in itself a narrative that's you know, that has a lot of instabilities and problems, you know, the same thing as you described, this complex system that we have of like international interdependencies and all that. Mm-hmm. That's true for this whole official narrative as well. You know, if, I mean, one of the major pillars of this house of cards is going to come down, you know, like say more and more unstoppable, more people with vaccination damages come up, and sort of the public opinion changes against the whole thing. They're not playing along with it anymore, and maybe don't believe in the idea of another virus or whatever, the 10th wave or so. Then this whole you know, crowd that is pushing in that direction, as we can see. I mean, what Whitney Webb also said, it's the same story all over, the same definitions. It's really a lockstep constellation around the world, maybe with a little bit of delay in the countries, you know, relative to one another, but it's the same thing. So do you think that this whole system that's so elaborately put together is also on the verge of breaking at this point? Or do you think it's all going according to plan?
I think it's both. I think there is a plan. I think the plan's going to fail because I think the planners of the plan don't appreciate how complex systems actually work. And complex systems in nature, they owe all of their complexity and their order to the flow of energy. So let's take the biggest complex system there is, the whole Earth. Right? It's just a glorious thing. We have octopuses and giraffes and crazy beetles, the color of metals. It's just an amazing, beautiful symphony of complexity, all because we have a constant daily output of amazing energy from the sun. If the sun went dark, if that energy went away, the Earth becomes a lot simpler, boring, dead, icy ball very quickly, right? So I think we can appreciate that at the super big scale, that because of the energy from the sun, the Earth is this amazingly complex thing. Great. Now let's say the economy. It's this beautiful, complex thing, as you said, with these interdependencies. We have this huge global web where even the technology we're using now, the computer and the camera I'm talking to you through, they probably traveled 30,000 miles each as they were constructed, from the sand that went into the chips to the components that were manufactured and built here and shipped there. 30,000 miles for that one thing. And so that's beautiful complexity. It owes all of that complexity, just like the Earth, to this input of energy. This is fossil fuels. This is oil in particular. Still, you look at flight tracker, all the planes in the sky, all of them are up there because of oil right now. You look at shipping traffic, marine traffic, and you look at all the container ships on the ocean, thousands of them. All of them are moving because of oil at this point in time. So that's our dependency right now. And as many gains as we've had with alternative energy, when you really look at the numbers, and I could show you charts and data and all this, which says, yeah, they're growing fast, but they still are just a thin smear at the top of our total energy use, a thin smear, almost like you have to squint at the chart to see them, compared to oil and gas and coal, which are still 80% of the total energy mix. So when we look at that, we are now in a really critical phase as a species, not as Europe, China, US, as a species, where for the first time in our species history, we're facing a leveling off of the amount of energy that we're able to extract, our primary sources of energy. And that's starting to nose over. That's what this next 10 years is about. It's a very awkward period of time. It's going to take extraordinary planning, sacrifice even. And I believe we could do it, but we have to have the right narrative. So I love the way you put that, the story about COVID, it's breaking down. We're finding out that even in a sort of poorly treated fashion, it has an infection fatality rate of around 0.2%. And that's clustered mainly in elderly people, and mainly elderly people with a lot of comorbidities. if you had early treatment, I bet we could get that down to 0.1% or less. And then we would find it's like the flu. And the question is, how many rights should you give up and how many dreams should you give up and should your businesses be closed and should your children be, you know, frightened and maybe traumatized, all to because of that. And by the way, if we are going to cower and quake at a 0.2% or maybe a 0.1% infection fatality rate, what are we going to do when these really big problems and predicaments come that could be far more damaging? Are we going to just, you know, crawl up and you know, wait for our leaders to save us? No, that narrative's breaking down. It's breaking down big time here in my country. People are beginning to wake up, and not a minute too soon, because we really have to get citizens back involved in our overall solutions. And I'm a huge believer that the days of centralized control and power are over. The CDC, it's not as smart as all these people who run blogs that I know, who go through the data and come to conclusions and make the right choices months ahead of giant multi-billion dollar, you know, organizations. So that's the genius of what the internet has given us. And it's the genius of real democracy, where the people actually are faster, smarter, more nimble, such as yourselves, coming to the figuring this stuff out way faster than the official narrative. But once people realize the narrative is broken, it's a very dangerous time. And that's why I think the European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, they're printing money like crazy printing. They know that when they do that, it just mostly goes to billionaires and makes the rich even richer. And that's socially corrosive. You know, as Plutarch said thousands of years ago, the oldest and most fatal ailment is of all republics is a gap between the rich and the poor. So they're creating this gap, but they don't know what else to do except print more, you know, and that's just what they do. That narrative, they're afraid if people catch on to that narrative and it breaks, then our markets break and financial systems break and then things break, and they're afraid of that. Politicians are afraid that if their narrative, if they get caught out for having lied about vaccines, vaccine injuries, herd immunity, all of that, when that narrative breaks, they're afraid that their political institutions, their parties, their careers will break. It's on and on and on. But the issue that you're up against and that, you know, I think is just absolutely right is the story is wrong. We have the wrong story. And when people have the right story, I have huge faith they'll do the right things. Absolutely. But when you have the wrong story, you prop it up as long as you want, but a wrong story will lead your business to fail. It'll lead your marriage to fail. It'll lead you to fail. Bad stories lead to bad outcomes. We're just running a story that just doesn't make sense on COVID, but that's a mirror of this larger story that doesn't make sense economically. And I know that's frightening for some people, but it's just reality too. And so is what it is.
We have to get a clear picture of what's really going on. You're right. If we're following the wrong story, we're not going to have the right responses. It's only logical. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the right to know about your physical condition. It's a comparative law thing. I looked at what was going on in the United States and in those states that had already agreed to a what is now called a durable power of attorney for healthcare, California and Oregon. I think they were the front runners there, while we didn't have that. And a lot had to do with the problem that people did not want to see what was really going on with their health. But you do have to know what's going on, even if it's terrible, because if you don't, you cannot react accordingly. Your response is always going to be wrong. And that is true for every walk of life, more or less, for economics in particular, I guess, because this is, we can see right now what's going on. The system is breaking down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it well said. And here's an example. So I get into these debates often with economists, and I'm not an economist, but you know, I play one on the internet. But I talk with them, and they have this underlying assumption, this dogma that sits under their entire profession, everything is built on top of this one assumption. And this assumption is you can grow forever.
Yeah. Which is obviously wrong.
It's obviously wrong.
Yeah.
Right? But when I try and debate them on that, they say, no, we're going to take that off the table. We want our debate with that off the table. It's like, you can't take that off the table. It's your primary error. And everything on top of it built off of an error is an error. So infinite growth, that's what economists are trying to achieve. And that's why we've seen trillions and trillions of euros and dollar printing, because they're just trying to keep, they need growth, you know? It's so wedded into their ideological dogma that if you go backwards, they call that negative growth, right? You know, it's just, yeah. So how do we go about changing this narrative from your perspective? What do we do here? How do we wake people up?
I think the only way is to educate people, to bring out the truth, to get them to understand the real facts. The funny thing is, it's not funny, it's eerie, that even though much of what we're discussing here in our sessions are so obvious, they're right in front of your face, they're in your face, some people seem to find it more comfortable to just sit back and wait until the government tells you where to go, what the next step should be, instead of taking responsibility into our own hands. I think you're right. We have to get people to not just sit there and wait, but to get involved, to take responsibility for their own lives. It starts in our families, and then it goes on into the communities, because we've been talking about this for a long time. Wolfgang Wodak, who's the guy who, Dr. Wolfgang Wodak, who's the guy who stopped the swine flu, which was their first attempt at this pandemic. He was only capable of stopping that and tearing down the other side's mask so as to show that it was just a mild flu. Because he had the power, he was then in a position, he was a member of the German parliament and he was also a member of the Council of Europe. But he's right from the start of this Corona committee, he's been telling people we have to think regionally, we have to take our sovereignty back from these supranational global corporations, NGOs, the Davos clique. We have to be responsible for our own lives, and that has to mean that we have to get involved. We can't just sit and wait for other people to make the decisions and tell us what to do.
I mean, the problem at this point in time is that you have a lot of people who have also emotionally invested a lot into the narrative. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe if you weren't able to visit your dying mother due to these, restrictions, then if you now have to realize, maybe it was not necessary to begin with, then it's very hard to face up to that. And it leaves you with a lot of guilt. Why didn't you speak up? Why weren't you more aggressive when the situation occurred? And so I think of course, it gives you a lot of, or can give you a lot of fear, you know, that you have to realize, wow, maybe it was financial interest driven what happened here, or like there were other reasons than just health aspects, you know, that led to that horrific, pandemic response constellation. So I think it's tough to people to wake up. But then we see also a lot of people who are now having serious doubts, and also in the ministries, the government, there's more and more people coming out, there's more and more doctors and people with influential positions who say, I cannot bear this any longer. And I think there's a lot there's a lot going on, and I think it's going to become like more and more obvious in the next few weeks, that it's really, especially when they're starting to, because that's what they have to do it over again, because basically once they let loose, the ends of this package that they've tied, it's all going to unfold, and you're going to see what's going on, that it wasn't necessary, because once you let go all the restrictions and nothing serious happens, I mean, people are going to have more and more questions. So I think they're under a lot of pressure, and the time is working, for us.
Yeah, but there will probably be a gigantic crash. The big question is, how do we deal with it? Can we? And I think the only way to go about it is by following your advice. What was your mantra? Plant your own garden, something like that. That's how it starts. We have to make sure that we connect with the farmers in our region so that we are not dependent on global supply chains anymore. This will not work overnight. We will have some serious problems as far as energy is concerned, probably just as well. I know I have a fireplace in my house, but how long is it going to last? I mean, the wood that it takes, you have to think about these things. But the most important problem, I think, is that there's two things. One, we cannot wait for everyone to come on board, because there are a lot of people out there. I hope it's not the majority of the people, but a lot of people out there who will not want to face up to this. They don't want to know these things because it shatters their whole world view. They can't come to grips with the fact that we've been lied to by our own governments and the mainstream media, whom they have trusted. The public here in Germany, the public media are very powerful, and many of the people of the older generation, they can't fathom that they're being lied to. So that's problem number one. And the other problem is that we may not, or some people are afraid that we're not fast enough, that we have lost so much time that there's nothing to save anymore. I don't think so. I think it's never too late.
You know what? I also think that it's... there's even more to gain now, because if it hadn't been like this, you know, we would have maybe been able to do some small adjustments, you know, for like a little bit of a better world. I mean, maybe cut down on whatever this hedge fund investments, you know, make these illegal or something like this. But now that people are, as a whole, so many people are asking a lot of questions now, and also having brought forward a lot of really good ideas how we could different, you know, design life, our social life differently. Like we had this guest earlier, you know, who had has good ideas about like new schools, like whole different system of learning, and, you know, giving, like producing an atmosphere where people can create ideas. And I think there's so many ideas out there already. So we just have to bring all this together. And then in this aftermath, or like while it's going down, we can already set up quite a bit of a new society, you know. And I mean, for instance, when we see there's a supply chain problem because of transportation issues, let's say that's the narrative, then we can already, like, you know, come together and see how can we organize transportation maybe in a better way, you know, like, I mean, already with the ones that are now working locally and organize ourselves to get, you know, overcome some of these problems, of course, not all of them. But I think it's really giving us, you know, opening up a lot of chances.
Exactly. So much wonderful things said there. And, you know, I started my whole career, I'm a scientist, so I brought a lot of data. And I realized early on that most people don't change their opinions or their minds because of data, because it's a belief-based process. So beliefs, I had to do this whole tour through behavioral economics, behavioral evolution, looking at psychology. I understand mass psychosis now. And long story short, it turns out that as humans, we tend to, the short circuit that nature has given us is to form a belief system. And it's stored down in we don't have one brain, we have a three-layered brain. And the deepest layer is very reactionary, and it's where our emotions are housed. And it's where nature said, yeah, we'll just record, you know, the operating system down there. And the rest are sort of add-ons. And so I understood early on now that to really be effective and influential in talking people, particularly who are invested in a belief system, data, it's not a data conversation we're going to have. It's not like we give them slightly better data, they process it, and now they think something new. Always, including for me and for you and for everybody listening, for everybody, once you have a belief system, to change it is always an emotional, not an intellectual process. And so understanding that is really, really important. So I know that there's a lot of people out there who are very, I call them deluded. There's these doctors, you know, that are literally killing their patients because they refuse to look at the early treatment data. And this is going to be a really hard moment for them to come to grips with that. And maybe they won't be able to while, you know, in this lifetime. But for now, my message to them is, listen, I think you have this wrong. And when you are ready to see it another way, or when you come to a different conclusion, I'll be here. We can have a conversation. I'm not going to rub your nose in it or spend time telling you how wrong you were or shaming you. I understand that I have to be as compassionate and as gentle as I can, because many of these people, I think we're all built differently. I think I'm built a way. Maybe you're built the same way. I don't know. But me and my tribe, we're built in a way where we're able to take new information, floods of it, and change our minds. And it's kind of I think it's a weird bell curve sort of percent of the population. But for a lot of people, they're not built that way. And the operating system is, you take your instructions from the tribe, from the larger, you know, from society. When that's wrong, and it's not just wrong, but it's wrong in a way that actually causes you to behave in ways that are morally indefensible, it's exceedingly psychologically difficult to face that. And I think there are going to be a lot of people having to face that. I have a lot of compassion for the pain they're going to go through. But in my country, my best guess is 80% of the doctors are going to have to face that at some point in time. And
same
it's here. It's
same in
tragic.
This country. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's part one. Part two of all this awesome stuff that's being talked about here is that the carrot and the stick, we're never going to shame people or berate them into this side. We have to, it's like Buckminster Fuller said, you never change an existing system by tinkering with it. You build a better model and you make the old one obsolete.
Yes.
So this old model is already obsolete by the numbers. How many overweight, unhealthy people on, you know, psychotropic drugs do we have? It's just astonishing. I was hearing, I think I might misremember the numbers, but I think Belgium has 13 million people and they consumed 300 million doses last year of, you know, SSRIs and other antidepressants, right? Mm-hmm. So you could just look at that as a Martian and say, we can do better, right? And people want to do better. We want lives of meaning and purpose and connectedness. And so there's a better life in front of us, all of this, but it begins with enough people saying, not this, I'd rather have this. And so that's where I'm putting more of my energy is how do we model this? How do we show this so that people can see there's a better life out there. Let's have a country of 13 million people with no antidepressants needed. That would be a better goal.
Yeah. And I think it's within reach right now. That's the, you know, it's the fact that COVID is more or less shaking up society is also probably a good way to wake up many people. Not everyone can be awakened, but more and more people are awakening, and that's what they're afraid of. That's what the other side is afraid of, because they're not fast enough to stop this, and they have run out of options. They have exhausted everything, all of their means. They can keep printing money, but even that is now probably completely fruitless. It's not going to help them anymore. So I agree with you. There's no reason for despair. We should be glad that finally our eyes have been opened. Because up until this, I have known for quite a while through my job, having to go to court, working for basically consumers and small and medium-sized corporations, I could see how corporations, large corporations, which are usually fraudulent corporations, like Deutsche Bank is one of the worst, or VW, I could see how they were under special protection in the courts of law. But I didn't put the dots together. I kept trying to think, well, maybe you, my colleague Catherine, maybe you should wear a different dress, or you should put on a different suit, or maybe we should get another expert opinion from one of the universities. No, that was not the point. The whole system was rigged, and now we can see it. And now we can change it.
Yeah, and that corruption is it's as old as history, right? Mm-hmm. And And so I think we have to sort of square up to the idea that corporations don't deserve special treatment. They're just groups of people. Mm-hmm. And to the extent to which we're just money focused, which is an old problem for humans, right? So it's sometimes people say money is the root of all evil, but that's not the quote. The quote is, for the love of money is the root of all evil.
Yeah.
For the love of. Mm-hmm. It's our relationship to money, not money itself. Money is neutral, but it's how we approach it. And so the things people do, like you mentioned, VW or Deutsche Bank or Monsanto, or we see things that corporations do for money that the individuals in those companies would never do. But as a group of people, because there's money and we have that shield of, well, you know, you make up some reason for why it makes sense, we're doing awful stuff. And by the way, money is not a real thing. It's a social construct. What's real is that our biosphere is collapsing. The warning signs I see ecologically are grotesque and disturbing. We see social issues. We can do better. That's the point here, is we can do better. And people want to do better. Those are the two things that need to come together in this story. So I'm excited, too, for this waking up that's happening. It needs to happen. And if COVID is the thing that causes that to happen, and we finally say, oh, this level of corruption is working against us and not for us, and we can't just look past it anymore, and we can't pretend as if it doesn't exist because my life isn't too impacted by it, I guess, too directly. That's no longer the case. And so, yeah, I wholly support any and all groups that are coming together on this. And it's time for us to band together and find the people who believe this way, all the different issues we might care about. I think there's one umbrella under this that we can come together around, which is we don't have the luxury anymore of not coming together. We don't, no decision is a decision at this point. It's like there's an avalanche coming down a hill. Mm-hmm. Standing there and not making a decision which way to run is a decision. So that's where I think we have to understand the severity of this situation. Collapse is not an impossibility in this story. I know it's remote in some people's minds or unlikely, but it's not an impossibility because it's all interdependent, and we've had defective, corrupt leadership that's been unable to do anything really constructive around this. Mm-hmm. China is not, you go to China, totally different situation, right? They're building thorium reactors, which someday we'll license from them at great cost, I assume. They're figuring out how to build electric cars, but not big, giant Tesla Roadsters with like awesome horsepower muscle. Little tiny ones that are probably 50 to 100 times more energy efficient that make a lot of sense. They are comporting themselves with a future of scarce resources and figuring out what's best for their country in ways that make sense to me. I don't agree with how they go about it or all of their things, but I am telling you, they at least have plans that make sense against this tapestry of financial and resource issues we're talking about.
We have to take a real good look at what's really going on so that we'll be able to make up our minds to make the right decisions. I don't quite understand the role of China. I just spoke, when we spoke with Whitney Webb, I think I mentioned that I gave an interview yesterday to Peter Breggin, who is one of the most important psychiatrists in the United States. He's the one who is basically responsible for getting rid of lobotomy. He's now 85 or 86 years old, but he believes that it's China which is really the source of all evil in this story. I don't quite agree with that. I know that they're part of the problem, and they're also one of the many different entities that are trying to divide the spoils of what they have just destroyed. But I don't quite understand. So I do think it's such, as you said at the beginning, it's such a complicated system that we're living in, and we must always take a close look. It's really important so that we will be the ones who decide what the Great Reset looks like, and not them, because they are the ones who brought us where we are right now.
Yeah,
but I think it's also important to maybe understand that What we've seen now, at least, like that there's so many people who are really full of good intentions, you know, and who really want to do the right thing. And, you know, there's actually only a very few who seem to be, pulling the strings somehow, you know, like what Whitney Webb says, that it's this Robert, what was his
name? Kedlick.
Kedlick, you know, who pops up in this situation, pops up here again, and then another time there, and like they're all connected. But it seems to be it's a small clique, kind of, you know. So it's also, that's why I have a good hopes that once we have overcome this kind of system, and we have, you know, like set up we must make sure that it's not never going to happen again, that a few people for their private interests, you know, can gain that much power again and really overtake a system that's meant for everyone. To their own benefits, you know, that's that we have to be very careful. But I think if we can do that and, get the swarm, you know, like everyone who has, who means well involved, I think we have a very good chance of rolling in the right direction, you know.
I completely agree. And I was really taken by a set of books, and I interviewed the author, Daniel Quinn. He wrote Ishmael, and another set called Beyond Civilization. It's just a beautiful little set of short paragraphs describing what it meant to be in civilizations. And by the way, we've been here before with this idea of a very tiny, tiny elite pulling the strings for their own benefit. And whether it was the Mayans or the Aztecs or any of these other ancient, you know, cultures, it's kind of been the same thing. Mm-hmm. And what he describes in his book, he said the only way, and again, this is sort of the idea of building a better model, he said the reason some of those civilizations collapsed, like the Mayans, the Aztecs, is that the people they were no longer in the thrall of the narrative of the time. So in the Aztecs' time, there were these priests. They had to sacrifice people. They were typically drawn from the poorer families. They put the people on the altars, cut their hearts out. The rains would come, right? And then, of course, the rains didn't come for a period of time. The narrative shattered. And he said the way that those civilizations collapsed usually was not in some big violent overthrow, is that the people walked away. Yeah. They just scattered back into the jungle in those times. But that's the modern equivalent, is people need to walk away. So you start by withdrawing your consent. And it's harder now because they have really good tools. But one of the great sins that Google and Facebook and Twitter and Instagram have pulled is to convince us that we're actually isolated and in the minority, and we're not. So one of the first things I do is I withdraw my consent to allow those social media outlets, although I'm on them every day because of my business, I don't allow them to control my emotions anymore or to allow me to form an opinion about how what my reach is, how important my message is, whether I'm being followed, all that. That's just junk. So withdrawing consent is the most important thing we can do. And that's where the elites get their power from, is that we consent to give it. So we have to withdraw that consent. And to me, I don't know any other way to do that except to get back to, like your other guest was saying, to get back to communities, yeah, to regions. Mm-hmm. We have to get back to that and start taking responsibility for our own selves. I do that in my town, right? So I bought a place, got some land, and I have cows now and chickens, and you know, that's what I'm doing. But I'm doing this in a way so that I'm building the resilience of my town. And I work with other people in town who share that same mindset, and there's quite a few of us. So then once I think other people see enough of us doing it, they come over and they say, what are you doing here? And I'm like, well, I have this really beautiful garden. I have this extraordinary place. I prefer to live surrounded by beauty and abundance. And so they can be attracted to the positive side of that message. And we hold real gatherings, and we talk about real things. You know, I had just had 100 people here last weekend, and it was fabulous. And the number one comment back was, oh my God, it was so relieving. Everybody there, we were having real conversations, you know? That's what we all want. We want to be connected. We want to have meaning and purpose. And that's the better life that sits out there. Not the one that Twitter and Facebook and, or is it called Meta now? Whatever.
Yeah.
That's a bunch of junk. It's just complete crap.
Listen, I was going to show you this picture because that's what this is all about. You've probably seen this before. I don't know if you can see this. It's about withdrawing consent. I'm going to get a little bit closer.
Yeah, closer, please.
Can you see this?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
That's what this is all about.
Yeah, exactly.
Let them go to hell. We can play our own thing.
That's what they're afraid of.
they're afraid of us understanding this, and that's what's happening right now.
Exactly.
So this is a very positive note on which we can end today's session. I like this. We'll be in touch, Chris. This was pure pleasure. I thought this was, oh my God, we can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, but this is great because we can see the light at the end of the tunnel now. We know what to do.
Yep, yep. So people often say, are you an optimist or a pessimist? And I say, I'm neither. I'm an optimistic realist. You have to have the realism in order to find the optimism. You can't ignore it. And yeah, it just doesn't work. So it begins with that hard work of getting to the reality and going, oh, that's, I wish it was different, but that's what it is. Oh, because now I know what to do, right? That's the relief in this story. So thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for being here. I think people will take a lot of comfort from what you had to tell us. And it shows us the right direction. It shows us that we're on the right track right now, even us. And by the way, it's happening in the U.S. as well. Not just with you, but there's many others. We had an active politician on our session a couple of weeks ago. Her name is Sue Frost. She's on the Board of Supervisors in Sacramento County. And she's telling me that she and a group of others, like-minded people, are now about to set up their own health insurance, which is completely different from what they have right now. It's much less expensive.
Mm. As it should be. I won't even tell you what I pay. It's like leasing two high-end Mercedes, you know. Every month for nothing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again. It's been absolutely wonderful.
And thank you very
hope
much.
We can do it again.
Yeah, we will. And have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.